Welcome to the Productivity Mastery Podcast, presented to you by myself, Stoyan Yankov, productivity and performance coach, keynote and TEDx speaker, and co-author of the Perform Methodology, and the book Perform, the Unsexy Truth About Startup Success. Join me on a journey to discover what some of the world's leading professionals do to be more productive, create peak performing teams, and build successful global companies. New episodes weekly. And now, enjoy today's episode. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Productivity Mastery, the podcast that's bringing you some of the most successful and inspiring leaders in the business world. And we have conversations around productivity, culture, entrepreneurship, leadership. And as always, I'm here with somebody that you really enjoy the conversation with. Not just enjoy, but I think you'll find some practical tools, ideas, examples that can be really helpful for you, no matter if you're executive or you're just starting your career or you're a startup founder. My guest today and I know each other from, I think, back 2017 was the first time I joined a conference in Austria in the little city of Graz called 15 Seconds. And actually, my guest today was the speaker speaking prior to me on the same stage. It was the media stage. And as I remember correctly, Melissa, you were speaking about something to do with virality and media.
Yeah. Wow, that was my first time there. Yeah, I was speaking about how to make things go viral. Long time ago, but
crazy.
Great memories. Yeah.
And Melissa was also one of the first guests of my podcast, which at the time was called Coffee and Productivity. And we were just sharing this memorable moment where maybe, Melissa, you shared a moment. What happened in our podcast?
Yeah, I was really into it, getting really animated. And then in the middle of our podcast, my cat decided to go up on the fridge and knock off a glass bowl this size, and it crashed in the middle of our podcast, and I had to compose myself and address it and then move on really quickly while I signaled to my husband that we had glass all over our floor. So Stoyan has that clip on demand, I believe, and probably publishes it pretty regularly. But yeah, great memory. Really,
it was a really nice reaction. I gotta tell you that. Like, Melissa was just like muting the sound. She's doing something, like whatever. but just to give the context to the people here, Melissa right now is serving as the chief creative officer at ClickUp. She's been an executive at BuzzFeed, and after that, she's been executive at Cheddar. And actually, I'm super curious if you can, Melissa, give us the 2-minute introduction of your career prior to joining ClickUp.
Yeah, absolutely. So my career prior to joining ClickUp, I had been in media for 10 plus years, served on the brand and creative side. I kind of went into media before it was really had been defined as what is media 2.0 for a generation of people that consume things on the web. So I started at BuzzFeed really early. I was the number 10th employee, and we hadn't quite figured out what the model was yet. And the internet was really the wild west. So a lot of experimentation. I love being part of hyper growth, small startups that I believe in what the vision is, the ultimate vision, and the mission of the company. And I love building things and disrupting. So I've been in media. And then after BuzzFeed, I went to go help start a company called Cheddar, which is a live streaming news network for millennials. We punched up against, CNBC and Fox Business. And we were capitalizing on a trend in which consumerization of cable bundles was declining while streaming services was on the rise. So the term that is pretty ubiquitous now called cord cutting was just kind of at its infancy. So we took advantage of that and really built a new brand of news for young people and really differentiated ourselves through brand and through everything that we did on that side. So and that kind of leads me to my big jump into SaaS and tech.
And why did that happen? Last time we had a conversation on the podcast in 2020,
when
your cat interfered, was also the time that you were building your own startup. And then a few months later, you were like, okay, let me let me switch. And then I see, like, I don't know, was it the Facebook thing moving to San Diego? Like, how did that happen?
It happened pretty, I mean, after we sold Cheddar and after I left, I was kind of in this like I guess the big question that everyone asks themselves after a big part of their career has ended, and it's sort of like, how do I reinvent myself and where do I end up next? And I had started a small like side project with my husband that we were working on building in tech, and tech started to really interest me, and the model and the idea of building content to support a product that can have ARR associated with it, and you're not actually selling the content as a product, was really appetizing to me and appealing to me. I had been selling content forever. Like that was the model that I had grown up on, and to be able to switch over to a model in which there's recurring revenue from like just as a revenue perspective, like was very appealing rather than to having to sell content, but also being able to work on content and to be able to work on creative that drives the revenue of that product rather than just the content being the product itself. So that was really, a big part in why I wanted to switch and go in-house at a brand that was building something that wanted to differentiate and believed in brand as a way to do that.
I'm curious, how do you make these career decisions? Because if you see from a side, obviously people say she's always taking these executive roles and she's super engaged in them, but also the kind of roles that you take are a little bit different, and the stuff that you do. So how do you decide on, and I think it could be really relevant for many people who are trying to figure out, how to navigate career-wise. How do you figure out what's the next step and what do I want to focus on?
I mean, I think it's a little bit of like gut and a little bit of, hey, what is actually like a viable revenue model? Like, I think as you grow up, you understand certain things about markets and models and revenue, and then also just like, where can I add the most value? And I think that my time in media in an industry that I had seen from its infancy and its rise to meteoric like levels and then crash back down, I really started to think about just industries as a whole and what makes a viable business model and how do I make a decision like that. I mean, I think that there are so many things that go into like making that next big career leap. I turned down a lot of opportunities because they just felt like stagnant. Like there was no room for disruption. It was a 9 to 5 job that paid well, but didn't allow me to do what I think I would be really excited to get up and do every morning. And that's, I mean, my career is a big part of who I am, and I'm passionate about what I do to a level in which, like, if I was just doing kind of the status quo and like I really didn't feel like I could make a huge impact, I wouldn't be happy. So there's a lot of things that like went into that, just like from a personal perspective too, of like, how do I want to feel every morning? Like I'm doing the hardest thing I've ever done, but I know that it'll pay off if I do it well. And I think that that's like what excites me and stresses me out. And then the stress fuels the excitement, and it kind of goes like that. But yeah, I mean, that was like the first part of like, what do I want to be doing? And I definitely, startups are their own beast. There's no guarantee that they're going to succeed. You can have luck in them. There's also an ability to just try to understand like business models a little bit more if you grow up and you have seen a lot of the different models out there and the different companies and what their strategy has been for exits and acquisitions and IPOs and what makes a really strong financial company, right? Like, how do you survive, basically? So I think there are just so many factors that go into that, which are very complicated. But at the end of the day, it's like, am I going to wake up every morning and be fulfilled and feel like I'm doing my passion and I'm excited about the people that I'm working with, and I feel like I'm ultimately working on a product that's making the workforce or the world a better place.
And ever since I met you, Melissa, you seem to be this person with so much drive, so much fire. And I don't think
Thanks.
it has changed since 2017. You seem to
No,
be getting more.
I was worried that moving to San Diego or Southern California would make me soft, but no, it just allows me to have a little bit of nature on the side of hustle.
I love
So,
it. I
yeah,
love it.
it's a good balance.
For the record, I'm just curious, how is your work week look like at the moment? Like, how many hours per week, like, in general, are you working, and how do you structure your work week?
That's a great question. So I have gotten into a pretty good routine, and I think people fall in and out of routines. So to be able to keep a routine for a long period of time that's sustainable, I don't think that's a reality. I think sometimes you're going out to dinner with your colleagues, or you're going to events after work, and you can't keep up like a very specific routine. But when I'm not doing that, I wake up around like 5 a.m. or 5:30. I work out. I need to work out in the morning to feel good. I start, doing things that I can get done pre-work. So I start thinking about like LinkedIn and things I'm going to post that day. And then I also start to go through all of my notifications from things that I've missed the night before, things I need to catch up on. And then I start to get like I start to focus on bigger projects that I might get distracted from during the day during meetings. So it's sort of like that my time, but it's my work time, but it's on my own time. And then I prep for anything that I might have coming up that day. So if I have podcasts or I have big meetings, I make sure that I'm doing all of that. And then by 7 a.m., I am either doing a little bit more of that if I already have meetings scheduled up, or I try to do podcasts at 7, because everyone comes online around 8. So if I can get two of those done by 8 a.m., then I feel pretty good. But yeah, I think it's, what I've learned is there are days in which like we do a lot of shooting. So we'll be shooting the full day. I'll be with my team. I'll be taking meetings in the interim. And then I like try to set some time aside in the evening for like deep focus, where at least 2 hours of my day is unobstructed from meetings. So I can just really focus on the projects that I want to think about. It's really hard to think, like to be able to have time to think. And I think that's the biggest like probably hindrance in productivity as a whole, outside of, a lot of the other just work challenges. It's like, how do you deep focus, and where do you set that time up? And like you can try to regiment it, but sometimes, obviously like obligations get in the way, and meetings and fires and things that you have to focus on. But I try to do that pretty regularly, and really just honestly go to bed pretty early. Like that, everyone is like, I stay up till 2 a.m. or that's not my style. I go to sleep by 10 p.m. so I can wake up at 5. So I'm just more productive. Like I thought I was more productive at night, but I'm way more productive in the morning. So I've switched my schedule, and I think the evolution and iteration of your own personal schedule and a regimen and productivity is should be ever evolving depending upon like how where you are in that moment.
And do you have any kind of a process, let's say? I mean, obviously you have this kind of I'm waking up at 5 until 7, I do this kind of thing and I have these meetings, but how do you sort of like plan the next day? Do you have like some sort of a to-do list process, or like you
Oh,
sit down
yeah.
for 20, 30 minutes? What do you do to say I'm going to get the most out of my day tomorrow?
Yeah, I mean, I constantly have like in ClickUp a task list of like a checklist of things that are not like they may not have big projects assigned to them, but they're the most important to-dos of the next day. And I'm filling those out consecutively throughout. Like I'll be doing that today, or not today, but I'll be doing that, every single, I'll be doing that today for Monday or the weekend. And I'm like, okay, these are the things that I need to get accomplished by Sunday or by Monday morning. And then to check those off feels really good, but I'm constantly like building and iterating on that list. And the list is probably like 50 things long, but checking those off daily and making sure that I'm making progress. Or they're also just kind of like flags to me to be able to be like, hey, these are the things that you need to focus on. They're the highest priority. And that's sort of how I'm able to focus on the right things.
So you are one of these people that actually really loves the product and utilizes the product to master your own productivity, right?
Yeah. I mean, the product is wonderful. I think the product I use mainly for work within my own team. The checklist is sort of my private work, my private like ClickUp version. It's like I have my own space where I have my checklist, and that's really just for me. But yeah, I leverage the product a lot. I mean, it's the product. It's a product of the product can work for you, like when you can integrate it within your life and within your work. And I do it on both sides. Obviously, within my work, it's like all of my work lives in ClickUp, so it's awesome because I can just go through my notifications and my outstandings and my to-dos and my assigned comments, and I know exactly what I need to do in ClickUp. And then on the other side of that, I have my checklist, and I understand what the bigger things that I need to focus on are.
And I'm just curious what percentage of your time weekly goes towards activities and tasks that are more like I gotta get things done, as opposed to activities and tasks connected to leadership, coaching, like more bigger picture, working with other people, delegation, and so on.
That's probably the majority of my week, which is, mostly like we have all these big projects, navigating them, moving them along, getting them to the next step, working with other people, scheduling meetings. I mean, as you grow from like it, there's challenges when you grow from 60 to 1,000 people, and some of those are that there are a lot of people involved in every project, right? So to make sure that that's like optimized for, success, and that like you're as efficient as possible, there's a lot of things that happen in different stages. So it's constantly moving that project through the different stages to make sure that we're actually be able to execute on it. So there's a lot of that, absolutely. Like, big campaigns have a lot of stakeholders. There's a lot of things that go into them, in every facet of that campaign. So it's a mix. It's definitely a mix. One-on-ones are a big part of my week. We've tried to cut down a lot on meetings. Only like, meetings that are really important are booked, and those meetings should be probably 30 minutes max, with a max of 5 people in them. Occasionally there are, the all hands, and your meetings where you're updating your team on goals and financials and your OKRs and things like that. But yeah, to cutting down on meetings and just focusing on the actual work is the majority of kind of where I spend my time.
So, do you do weekly one-on-ones with your direct report?
Yeah, I do weekly one-on-ones with my directs, and then we have a team meeting 3 times a week where we just go over all of our outstanding projects, where they are, any blockers. My goal is to unblock people as quickly as possible. So if there's something that's stuck, if we uncover that in the meeting, I try to move that forward. So those meetings are useful to really uncover anything that might be holding us up or holding us back, or things that might be red flag that we may not be able to hit deadlines on, and to be able to bring those up proactively. So those meetings are pretty productive and efficient. If they're not going to be, I cancel them. But yeah, I have weekly meetings with my one-on-ones, and then I do skip levels every other week, where I meet with different members of the team that are a skip level below me, just to check on them, make sure they're doing well, make sure everything is going well for them, and any projects I can help with or things that are stuck.
Yeah. And I wonder if there's any kind of a tool that you're using in order to, we were having this discussion in, I was in Bilbao, I just shared with you, I was in Spain, right? And we had the 2-day training with a bunch of startups. And there was this question, well, look, these to-do list tools are really good. It's amazing. But sometimes we get too much down in the trenches that we forget about the bigger picture. So I wonder, how do you get out of the day-to-day and you stay focused? Like, do you have any process of, hey, I need to define my personal priorities as an executive? Like, what do you do to make sure that you're not spending way too much time on things that shouldn't be done at all at this very time?
Yeah, I mean, that's like if you're finding yourself in the weeds too much on certain things, you have to delegate it to your direct reports or the leaders underneath you, and say like, I'm spending way too much of my time here. Like, this isn't a good use of my time. Like, I need to, like, I trust you. And I mean, the people that work for me, like at this point, we've worked together over 2 years. Like, I trust them. And I trust them to be able to make decisions and calls. And I think sometimes you just need to like say, hey, like, I trust you to make this decision. Like, you go with what you think is right, or I'm too in the weeds here. So it's constantly getting yourself out of the weeds, but that happens so often. And like, it to your point, it is like you have to take a step back and realize that you are in the weeds to be able to get out of them. And sometimes it just becomes so natural to be like, I need to get like put my fingertip, like my fingerprint on every single thing that happens here, rather than like, hey, I trust this team to be able to do that. And I think that's the key. Like, sometimes I see executives that are like so in the weeds of everything, and it's like, you got to put trust in your team to be able to execute on certain things without you. Otherwise, you're not going to be able to like level yourself up. And obviously, I think a lot of people use the method of like firing yourself, but it's kind of like constantly firing yourself from the job that you're doing today so that you can focus on the bigger picture and the bigger executions and initiatives that you need to focus on.
Have you been more of a control freak when you started in BuzzFeed as opposed to now?
I mean, I think it's both. Like, whenever you start at a startup, like every single thing that happens, it like when you're 60 people and you're an executive, like you touch everything. I was touching things that I had never done before. And I was doing them because, like, there's no one else to do them. I'm going to be a team player. They're fun, exciting. I get to learn a lot. And I'm going to play ball and I'm going to do all these awesome. I mean, that's the beauty of working at a startup. If I wanted to work on one thing or do things that I've done for 10 years, you go to move to the next level at a company that wants you to work 9 to 5 in your lane. So I think that's like really the beauty of being, or having the ability to work on so many different things and wear so many hats when you're in an early stage company. So being a control freak in that capacity, absolutely, because it's the first time you're working on things. You want to be meticulous and you want to have that overview and that touch, and you're defining everything too. When we first came in, like, we're defining our tone, we're defining our brand, we're defining our motion graphics language and our style and our design. And like, how do you do that without having like a really close touch to everything? But after time, if that's done well, it should level itself out where everything you're doing is raising the bar constantly and you're feeling good about that, and you're things you're doing are starting to pay off. So it's having that, like, being overbearing on things to start, not in a way where you're, like a tyrant to people, but in a way in which you involve yourself a lot in a lot of things often.
You know, one of the things about your profile and your career path is really interesting to me is that you've been an executive in three super successful companies, high growth companies, and that means you've been working directly with the CEOs of these companies. I wonder, the three CEOs that you had to work with, did they have different leadership style? And how did you adapt and what did you learn from each different CEO that you had to work with?
That is a great question. Okay, so I would say I worked with Jonah Peretti, and I would say mostly Jonah and John. John became my boss then, who was the president of BuzzFeed. I worked with Jonah for a little bit, and when I was working with Jonah is very smart but high level, creative, visionary, like coming up with the wackiest ideas. He is like the creative leader. So working with him was very interesting and cool and experimental, and he was just like excited about what he was building, and that was the time in which I was working with him. John is much more of a, like, let's get it done, let's do it, like fast pace, fast talker. He's great, he's super motivating, he pushes you. The man gets stuff done, like he is. I followed him to Cheddar, to build Cheddar, because I believed in his ability to build something really amazing. And we did that in 3.5 years. And it's not without his rigor and his dedication and his work ethic, and also his just like the way he thinks about things is really smart. So yeah, working with John is obviously very different than working with Jonah. And then, Zeb, I part of the reason, I mean, a big part of the reason that I joined ClickUp was Zeb. Zeb had never really worked at a SaaS company before, which was very appealing to me. So, the guy that's building a SaaS company that had built other successful ventures, but never SaaS. And I love that because I'm like, okay, this guy is going to be willing to take risks and bets and not go with the status quo. So Zeb is also like a very creative, bold person, wants to do things that are like splashy and risky and take bets. But at the same time, he's a brilliant businessman and a product visionary, and watching Zeb build ClickUp and understanding what the market needs and like his mission and vision for the company has been very inspiring. So it's like a complete, run of the gamut, running from like a media company to then someone building his first real SaaS company from, to a $4 billion valuation has been nothing like I could ever imagine. It's wild. And, him evolving also like from this 60 person small company leader to a CEO of a 1,000 person company is also really interesting. So yeah, I've been very lucky to be able to work alongside people that I've seen adapt and grow, another cat, adapt and grow and just evolve themselves. And I think that's the coolest part, seeing like someone that is able to grow themselves and is definitely not the same person that they were the year before, because they understand the needs of the next phase of their life in order to get there is just fascinating. Like I hope maybe Zev writes a book one day on his journey of how like what it was like to launch ClickUp with three people to grow it to a 1,000-person company and still be CEO and head of product at that company. I mean, it's wild. So yeah, I've been very lucky. I think working alongside people like that is what you dream of as someone that aspires to be successful.
Just for the fun of it, to get really concrete,
Yeah.
the first lesson that comes to mind from each of them, like one thing that you never thought of, but you learned to do it because you were working together with them. What's the one thing for each of them?
Oh, that is a great question. John put me into roles and positions that I certainly wasn't ready to take on, and I thrived and excelled because I learned a lot from him in the way that he went about things. And they were unconventional and they worked always. And that was the biggest lesson I learned from him. Like, he taught me that there's kind of unlimited optimism in the way that things can be done because there's just when there's no playbook for it, that is the biggest opportunity in the world. And I think my kind of fearlessness in business and breaking the mold and being disruptive definitely comes a lot from John. And just like seeing him do things that people bet against him, you know, like so many people bet against him in so many times. And like he fought through that and just focused on his vision and did it through, you know, brute force of of execution and like ultimate style of execution. And yeah, I mean it's wild what John's accomplished. So definitely that from him. And from Zeb, it's kind of like just the path to growth and growing yourself. I think he's been so dedicated to that. And over the past 2.5 years, seeing him grow from a Series A CEO to a Series C CEO has been really amazing, like having one-on-ones with him. He's also incredibly perceptive. And like the feedback he's given me has been like the best feedback of my life. It is so intuitive, like to how he works with people and understands where
I
they're
want to stop you here.
strong.
I want to stop you here
Yeah.
because I'm curious. What about this feedback? It makes it really special.
You feel like he really pays attention to a lot of small details and is very aware of everything. And you feel beyond seen and understood. And the ultimate part of that feedback is I want you to grow. And I see this growth path for you. This is where I think you can improve. And it's hard feedback to read. I mean, like I got emotional reading it. But at the end of the day, the intention behind it is so pure and positive. And it comes from such a good place. And it's like, I see you as this leader. Like, these are the things you need to do to get there. I've never received feedback like that. It was amazing. So, yeah, I mean, just like working alongside him and seeing him like really look deeply into the work, what I was doing to be able to write something like that for me, I've never received that before.
Did you cover three of them? I think you did.
Yeah, those are my,
Okay, 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 okay. Because Jonah, I'm getting, a little.
Jonah was very early BuzzFeed before John.
Okay.
And he was that creative genius type, you know, like the one that was gonna change media forever. And that was his style. And John was definitely his like complementary business guy.
Got it. When you mentioned creative and creativity, I've been so proud of you, Melissa. I know you're a rock star. You've been a rock star for the last couple of years. It's just like I open my LinkedIn. It's like, wow, Super Bowl ad,
Yeah.
conference on productivity, completely transformative. All these campaigns that were you guys were pushing out, coming back to the office, and like, there were so many, and all of them were like, I don't know, there's something fun, there's something fresh, there's something that I want to watch. But he's also using some traditional formats at some point. So I wonder, if you kind of look backwards, for you, which were the campaigns that were most meaningful or really touched you?
Yeah. Well, first, I just want to say, like, thank you. That means a lot. I really can't take much credit for that. I hire people that I trust to be able to, like, execute and that I believe in their vision for what they'll bring to the table. and I let them go pretty much. You know, we have a great relationship, but I can't take credit for that stuff. They're just my team and I love them, and they're the reasons why all that has been brought to life. And I hired them very early on. I feel like we just have the best in class creative marketing team on the planet. Like, I feel so lucky. So I just want to say that I never want to take credit for their work. But yeah, I mean, our campaigns have been like really fun. And I think it's because when I first went into SaaS, I saw this kind of blue sky opportunity that you could, you know, have a little bit more fun with your campaigns, and no one was doing it. And I was like, there's no reason why you can't infuse humor while still being a serious company. So, you know, that was kind of the thesis of like, hey, let's just be this heroic jester. At the end of the day, we like will save you time, we'll save you money, we'll make you more efficient and more productive, you and your teams. But we can also have fun and be very self-aware within that notion, right? And how do we play to that? We can play to the things that people really resonate with around work, around culture, around what's happening in technology. And I think when you're able to bridge that gap between like what are the pain points of like your end customer, thinking about it from like an actual like go-to-market standpoint, but you're also able to touch into that zeitgeist of like what's happening today and what are the things that are people struggling with and how do you make those humorous? Like that's how you're going to resonate with them. So, you know, that's been kind of just the mentality of how we do things. Yeah, was really proud of the returning to work campaign. I think, you know, being able to touch on a point in office culture, work culture history, where every single person was experiencing the same thing around work at the same time, like, I think it would have been silly for us to not try to take advantage of that. Like, there's just never been or very few points in time where everyone is experiencing this overarching like change and shift in work and environment. So we decided to do that, and I think we did a really good job. You know, the message wasn't focused on product, it was focused on, hey, like the awkwardness of going back to the office, of shaking hands, and all the simple things that we used to do before that have changed. Like, we can't handle that, but we can take care of all the you know, productivity and all the efficiency. So, you know, proud of that message, and I think we executed it pretty well with the humor attached to it. And then another one I'm pretty proud of is the Jira campaign. I think that was certainly very polarizing to decide to punch up against one of your biggest competitors, who's kind of like that 500-pound gorilla in the room, Atlassian, and you know, take some jabs at them. And you know, I was nervous to do it because that type of advertising, that like competitive jabbing at your competition is definitely a polarizing way of advertising,
For the audience who's
especially
not aware,
internationally.
can you just with a few words share what actually happened?
Yeah, absolutely. So Jira is one of our biggest competitors. They serve mostly the engineering community, and they are owned by it's a part of the company Atlassian. And we wanted to do a large campaign against Jira because we knew that we could win against them in market. So we created a series of, you know, a pr pretty much full strategy across the board, across demand gen and email campaigns and every single thing that would go into a fully, you know, integrated marketing campaign. But we created a series of videos, and they were all about firing Jira. And one that I think maybe some people have seen, maybe they haven't. We did a parody on a pharmaceutical ad where we called ClickUp a beta tool, and we highlighted the pains and the points of suffering, and we did it in the style of like a traditional pharmaceutical ad. So people, you know, put their head in their hands, like, you know, like just in despair because they haven't experienced ClickUp before. And then, you know, obviously the mood shifts when ClickUp, a beta tool, is introduced, and the sun is shining and people are playing. And it's just this dramatization of like what the pharmaceutical ads do. So we use a lot of the tropes that do well or that are just very well known that people can relate to immediately. And then we tie the messaging into those because already you have context, right? People understand that setup, And once they understand that setup, they're way more likely to, for it to grab their attention in the first 5 seconds. Oh, I know that. That looks like an infomercial. That looks like a pharmaceutical ad. That looks like an SNL skit, which it kind of was. It was like a mix between an SNL skit and like a pharmaceutical ad. But, we were jabbing at our competitors, but I think people were so, I think, they, I mean, people thought it was so funny, mixed with the fact that it was so smart in the way that we took them on, that I don't think I think it resonated pretty well. And of course, you're going to get a couple of people that just don't like that style of advertising, but the majority, the sentiment was pretty high for that campaign.
Can you bring us inside the kitchen though? Like we only see the end result. Like I see all these campaigns on LinkedIn. I'm cheering for you guys, and really, I'm not BSing. I'm just telling what I feel. I feel the kind of creative work you guys do is absolutely, at least relating to me. But I think it's brilliant. It's really smart and relatable. But I wonder, what does it look like to be in the kitchen, the creative kitchen of ClickUp? Like you guys kind of meet up and put all these post-it boards and like how do you generate these creative ideas that you turn into a campaign?
Yeah, so we have we have a couple of different ways of thinking about campaigns. We have our always evergreen, always on machine of the brand content that we're producing. So we're producing 3 things a week. Those are all shot like in-house, in office. Like we're utilizing everything that we can to put those out, and then still make commentary in a smart way on AI and ChatGPT and things that are happening while still tying our product in. And the brainstorm there is you're right. We all get in a room. And we start thinking about the things that are trending and the work pain points people are suffering with. And we create a whiteboard in ClickUp, which is awesome. And we actually just assign different like ideas to it. And then if those ideas are able to be populated into like a real idea, we start putting those real ideas into a document. And then we decide out of that document, like what are the things that we want to move forward with? And then we try writing them. We do also like we've been utilizing AI. Not as a crutch, but as a almost like a secondary like feeding board. So we have an idea and we're like, make this funnier or twist this to do X. So we're able to like kind of take away like once we have a great idea or we have a script, we utilize AI a lot. It's been helpful in the just the pure amount of volume that we have. Campaigns like larger campaigns that touch a ton of people are very different just because holistically, you're designing landing pages, you're designing a demand gen email strategy. So, you kind of have to start from a layer and be able to build down on that layer, which is involves a lot more stakeholders and a lot more people. But, across the board, it's definitely like a very collaborative process. It's exactly what you would imagine. We actually just released a ClickUp Writers Room ad, which is kind of this meta ad about how we created another ad. And it's kind of a joke look into our writers' room, but it's not that different. I mean, it's a bunch of very creative people thinking about how do we touch on these 3 things that are important to the company and how do we resonate with prospect audiences and our existing audience in a way that will be meaningful enough for them to share with other people within their companies and other executives they know.
And how much structure is needed for creativity to be effective? And in other words, also maybe practically, like, do you guys set any specific kind of metrics and structure and processes? Because you can't be just all around the place creative. Like it needs to be, at the end of the day, achieving specific results.
Yeah, I mean, we certainly have like, hey, are we reaching our core ICPs? Can we pull that data from the platforms that we're utilizing, and are we hitting the certain amount of impressions? And if we're doing both of those things, then we're achieving our goals. Because at the end of the day, like, top of funnel, middle of funnel, like the attribution model for some of the stuff that we're doing is very hard to measure. While B2C is like, oh, you just need to do this because you're marketing all the time and you need to stay top of mind all the time. I mean, I kind of agree. I certainly agree there should be metrics attached to it, but at the end of the day, if you really want to be top of mind, and when you think about like our TAM, like our total addressable market, it's as I mentioned, it's everyone in teams of 5 to 10 to thousands of people across marketing and IT and HR. So we're really trying to reach like every single knowledge worker out there. So we're able to have a little bit more freedom with the types of content that we're creating on a regular basis. outside of these very highly structured campaigns. So while there is structure, there's sort of like structured chaos, right? Like you constantly have to be trying different things. We're not just like, we're going to create a series for 5 weeks and expect that series to work. We're constantly testing new things. We want to newsjack and be able to take advantage of things and trends that are happening within work that we can touch on the next week. So, the metrics of like, are we reaching the right people? At the right companies, at the right title levels, are these things being spread? Are we making noise? Some of the anecdotal stuff. And then also are we hitting a certain amount of impressions that we wanted to know that we have a reach that we're able to have? And then also, how valuable are those impressions on different platforms? Obviously, like impressions on TikTok, depending upon who you're hitting, are very different than impressions on LinkedIn, that are different than impressions on YouTube. So I think it's just also thinking like critically about like, are you reaching the right people in the right places with the right message?
Right, and one is impressions, and I guess at the end of the day, you want to get more people to use the platform and potentially become your clients.
And we hear that all the time anecdotally. Being able to map that back, are like dollar for dollar, like it's challenging. I mean, will there ever be a perfect attribution model that will capture all of that? I mean, it's a full part of the journey. When you think about signing up for something, it's you have multiple touch points around that service before you do. And maybe the last touch point is seeing a video. Maybe the last touch point is a customer testimonial. Maybe the last po touch point is me telling you how amazing ClickUp is. But to be able to get credit for that last touch, I think is really challenging because it's such a part of a fluid journey that really is so hyper dependent on that case and that scenario. So I mean, I believe that you have to be able to rent space in people's mind and stay top of mind, you have to be creating this content constantly, especially if your addressable market is that big.
Yeah, and I can imagine a lot of it is the branding piece and the brand awareness, right? It's like
Yeah. A lot of it is top of funnel, 100%. Some of it is more middle funnel, but I was on a podcast last week, and they reached out to me, and they're like, "Hey, just saw the awesome stuff that you guys are doing at ClickUp. Like, wanna jump on a podcast?" And I was like, "Sure." And they were like, "Actually, we had never heard of ClickUp before we saw something that was shared with us. This like tr this dystopian trailer about AI that you guys created, where like everyone is gone and the only thing in the office is AI and this one employee, and then AI is like a complete jerk and like and the message they were like, I think it was like, let's work together, and then it was an ad for your own AI product, your own AI feature, and I was like, oh, cool that you saw that, and they're like, yeah, we've never seen anything from ClickUp in the past, and now we're all on ClickUp, and I was like, that's awesome, like and obviously. Where I'm not getting that data outside of hearing that from them, but knowing that we're hitting the right people with the right messaging is really obviously a good step in the right direction.
And to get back to the creativity part, how do we coach, from your experience, how do we coach creative people to be more, rigid, disciplined, structured? So they, many people are struggling with that, the highly creative people don't necessarily, have the work ethic, the discipline, the, deadlines, so sometimes a challenge. So do you guys do something specific to balance out the creativity
Yeah, I mean,
aspect?
I realized early on that there's a crucial role within creative, and a lot of people have this. This isn't like rocket science, but it's having creative operations. So we have someone on our team who is responsible for creative ops, and that person handles like a lot of our processes, a lot of our deadlines in terms of just like making sure things are being delivered. Because to take away the brain space from the people that should just be solely focused on building and creating, I think that's a waste of their brain space, right? Like you want to optimize to get the best out of everyone. If our motion graphics designers are focused on deadlines and optimization of workflows like completely, they're taking time away from the stuff that they're best at. So we have someone that helps out with that, and he's amazing. He's built out just incredible systems for us. He's a creative, guy himself, so he really understands the mindset of creative people, and ultimately it's to get the best out of it. So while companies have like, project management offices company-wide, he's our head of creative ops. So he is really the driving force behind our operations, and I think every creative team, as you scale, you'll need an ops person to make sure that you're able to get the most out of your team, and they're not hyper focused on the operations part when they should be focused on the creative part, but still being able to have that structure and that, you know, like we're delivering on time and we're supporting an entire company. We have to be able to do that. So it's setting it up for success.
I love that. You know, understanding your people very well, where their strengths and where they're not so good at, and trying to kind of maximize on the things that are naturally they're talented at.
And
What?
they'll be happier too. Like if you have a creative person who's spending half their time managing like workflows and deadlines and processes, like they're not going to be happy.
Definitely, definitely. Melissa, I'm very curious, and I know you joined the company not from the very beginning, but I listened to another podcast with you preparing for this one, and I checked your webpage, and I gotta say, with your permission, I want to use your values and the way they're structured as an example for other companies, if you allow me to, because I think they're so well structured. I just love the, you guys can go check out clickup.com/about, if I'm not confused.
That's where they live.
Yeah, so you can see the mission, and you can see, and I'm gonna read you the mission. The mission is save people time by making the world more productive, simple, clear, to the point. But then the values, I just love that they're no BS, but they're what you guys believe in, and their language in a way that I'm gonna read them just for the audience. Deliver the best customer experience, comma, period. That's number one. Number two, no politics. Number three, normal effing sucks. Number four, get shit done and have fun. Number five, grow 1% every day. And number six, random acts of kindness. I wonder, I don't know if you're aware, if you were part of it, but what was the process of discovering these values and language in them? Like, did that take some time? And how did they evolve?
I've had core values. I feel like at BuzzFeed, it was challenging to get them. Like, no one could agree on them. I think we finally agreed on a mission, but at Cheddar, it was like day one, we need to have core values. Like, these are the things that we want the people that work here to align with in their trajectory and their belief system, and then things that they actually embody. At ClickUp, I came in and we did, there were core values because I think Zeb believes very strongly in having them too. But they've evolved over time and, you know, through leadership retreats. And it's like, you know, every 6 months or, you know, probably every 6 months, you should evaluate like where, cat. You should evaluate like where you are as a company and like what that looks like. This is my cat, by the way. This is
Is that Rocky? Is that
it's
Rocky?
Bump, it's Bumple, it's Bumple.
How many do
You
you
should
have?
three. You should evaluate where you are as a company and what makes sense, right? We change our core values pretty often to reflect the company at that current stage. And I think that's the perfect way of doing it because, like, you're never going to stay the same company, especially when you're growing so quickly. So, how do you make sure that your core values align for where you are now? But honestly, like, I would give our core values credit for scaling the way that we've been able to scale with the type of people we've been able to hire. I think without having those strong core values and like being like, wow, like most of the people that work at this company really do embody all of these things, or at least a few of them that really resonate with them, is really powerful because those are the people that you want to be working with. And it's almost this like trust system. It's like when I work at ClickUp, this is the type of environment I'll be working in, and these are the type of people I'll be working with. So it's kind of a commitment both ways. It's like you'll believe in these, you know, you'll kind of live your work life to these core values. Some will resonate more than others, but at the same time, like it's a commitment to you that, you know, these are the types of people and the environment that we're going to foster here.
So how did you guys manage to sustain the culture and the values from growing so fast? You know, you were 60 people, then you grow to 1,000. Like, what made you, you know, it's easy when you're a small team, right? But when you start growing so much, how do you sustain the culture?
I mean, it becomes like more team dependent than it does company dependent because each team is responsible for creating their own value. I mean, not values, but basically interpretation of those values and how it works within their own specific unit. So not that, you know, every team structures the same way, but how do you adopt those to make sure that they still align to what your core values are as a company, but it makes sense for the environment that you're trying to foster within your own, you know, unique team. And what does that look like? And I think that that's how you scale it. You have to basically embed those core values within all of your leadership who are leading other people and figuring it out what it actually means for that team. And I think once you're able to do that, you know, you've developed several cultures in a way. Like teams have different cultures, they just do, but they're still aligned to the core values that the company is set.
Yeah. And do you guys, in terms of talent attraction and how much is culture fit a factor? Like if you find this super high performing person, but they're not necessarily a culture fit, like is that like a no-go? Or like how do you make sure that you bring not just the best people, but the people who are feeling that they belong to your thing?
I mean, I would say that in most cases, like if it's not a culture fit, like it's going to be a no. Like it's not going to, like we won't hire that person. And I think that if it ultimately isn't a culture fit and we've hired them, it doesn't work out. Like you find out very quickly, like, you know, we're a fast-paced, collaborative, creative, very like, you know, respectful culture. And if you don't fit that mold of like, you know, one of our core values is get shit done and have fun, like you have to be that type of person. So if you've worked at a legacy company for 25 years and, you know, like you don't respect other people and you're just kind of like, I do my job and like that's it. And like there's po politics involved, just doesn't work. It just doesn't end up working out. So we have a great team of recruiters. They try to screen for that immediately too. Like that's sort of the first step. It's like, is this person a culture fit? If they have the hard skills, do they have the soft skills? And like, would they be a culture fit here? But yeah, if they're not, it very quickly is apparent.
No, you. We talk about the leadership styles of the people that you worked with, your CEOs, but I'm also curious from your direct reports. You mentioned at the beginning we have to be personal and give people space to have their own productivity style. I just wonder if you can think of the people that you manage, like, is there like three of them with very different style when it comes to productivity and work organization, workflow, and so on. And if you can maybe share, if you think without mentioning names, of course, and do you as a leader needs to change your coaching and leadership style in order to get the best out of them?
Yeah, sometimes. I mean, some of them are very type A, like everything needs to be very X, Y, and Z, and that works for certain aspects of the role, but then others I'm like, we just need to get going on this. Like save type A for 3 months down the line when we need to be type A. And like right now it's we just need to focus on like moving forward and like getting things out the door. So you have to coach people on that because I think like the type A people are the hardest because they're like, I want to do things perfectly. And it's like, yes, of course, we all do, but like right now it's let's move. And then we can focus on the perfection and the parts of the things that we can refine. So you know, there's definitely some coaching there. And then there are people that are like creative, free flow. I want to like just be absolutely creative. And it's kind of like, okay, but here's the bigger picture. Let's think about it this way. And then more of just like that, like strategic, like chats of like, this is how I'm thinking about it. But I try to be very open and transparent with my team to the ability that I'm able to, and like tell them how I'm feeling and how I view things and have like constructive dialogue where they don't feel like I'm, you know, in this position of telling them what to do. I'd rather them tell me what they're gonna do to fix something or change something. And then I can say, hey, this is why I agree with it or not. I also don't want to stand in the way of people in which I believe have a more of a skill set or more of a deeper understanding of something, right? Like if you hire experts in fields, like you should be able to trust them to do something without micromanaging them. So it's just a balance of, hey, like I think this is how we should approach this. Why don't you take it from this angle? Come back to me and let's see where we are. Versus like, this is how we need to do it. This is exactly what we need to do. Like I don't really approach things that way. I like to see what people can come up with and then workshop it with them. I also really love the style of like being a player coach as a leader, I think that's like where I'm the strongest. And I love working alongside my team and creative people in general. And that's what works for me.
Melissa, you are an impressive young woman. You
Thank
are a
you.
leader that I admire, and many people do, and they follow you. And I think most people looking at you, they think this lady has it all figured out, right? Like she has this confidence, she's strong decision making, she knows where she stands, I can rely on her, I can trust her, she'll take the right decision, right? I wonder, do you ever feel I'm not good enough? Do you ever have self-doubt, and how could people listening potentially develop self-confidence and self-belief?
Yeah, I mean, of course. I think like that probably is true of anyone. And to say that I have it all figured out, like I think it's just I've always forged forward and taken risks and bets on myself and tried to figure things out. But to say that I haven't experienced like self-doubt along the way around decisions and had that anxiety and failed, like obviously I have. But I would say like making your voice heard and feeling confident enough to feel like you have something important to say in a room is step one. Like believing in yourself and saying like, okay, my opinion is valuable enough. Like I'm going to do this and I'm going to say this because I believe it. Like starting to do that, you develop everything I believe is like a muscle. So starting to do that and develop that muscle, you start to kind of get that like dopamine out of that. And then I think it really kind of just it grows. Like it grows and you become stronger and that muscle develops and then you're able to do that in other areas and facets of your role. And I think that that's probably the key to developing confidence. It's just doing. It's just doing. And it's being like not afraid to fail. And hopefully you have leaders and support and people that are like, if you fail, it's okay. It's because you tried and you did all of these things and we're never going to be perfect, but we work towards it. And that's the mentality of, I think, someone that will be in the position to be able to become their best version of themselves. And I think I was always very lucky with my leaders where like I always felt that. So, even when I felt, a lack of confidence in something I was doing, like there was a lot of support along the way. So even if it was like, you're gonna fail. We all know that. We're all gonna fail at things. Like, let's just like forge forward and learn from our mistakes, right? So I don't know. I think it's finding those people that will have you and support you and have your back, so that you're able to develop that confidence and then starting to speak up and believe in yourself and believe in you, trust your gut. I would say there are so many times that I believed things that like I knew intuitively were not probably correct, and like you're fed into like a model of like just maybe like just a matter of because the majority thinks something like you should think it too, rather than like this isn't tangible. Like really small example, this is I'm deviating here in a major way, but when everyone was talking about crypto and blockchain and this and that, the amount of people that actually understood what the technology was and how it would be able to impact the world versus the amount of people that were speaking on it in every panel. It was like blockchain, 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 crypto, 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 right? And then it created this whole thing of FOMO and this whole group of fake experts. And I would sit down at night and I would talk to Jeff and my husband and we'd be like, I don't understand the practical use for a lot of this. And we'd be like, are we missing something? Or is the whole world just trying to jump on this trend in which like they don't understand it either, but to feel like confident they're doing that. So I think there's a lot of like trust your gut. If you were doubting that because you couldn't tangibly really understand it, maybe there was a reason. Not saying that like that's true in every case, but look at AI, right? It's such a tangible thing. Every day I'm able to go into work and utilize AI in different ways. People are building it into their products to alleviate from mundane work to make themselves smarter. Like I see that happening, and that's why I believe in that. So I think it just goes back to like trust your gut, trust your intuition. Like if there's a reason something feels like it's not right or that's not the right decision, like speak up.
A final question I want to ask you is connected to our upcoming book, actually. As you know, Melissa, I already reached out to you. Our second book is called Perform in Times of Crisis, and we are learning from people, you know, practitioners like yourself, what people do in difficult times, in you know, from the one side, the small fires we need to put out, but on the other side, major crisis. And I wonder if you can maybe reflect and share maybe an example or just an advice, but like, what do you do? What should leaders do? Or maybe what have you done when you successfully managed a crisis?
I mean, I guess it depends on the type of crisis. There's like crisis within a campaign or crisis within a process or something that's broken within the company or something that happens. There's that. And I think it's for that, it's keep your team calm, explain what the challenge is, what the issue is, and focus on fixing it. There will be a retro in which you'll be able to go back and discuss what went wrong. But at that moment, it's no politics, no blame, focus on fixing it. And get everyone together who needs to be involved in that decision and how they're going to fix it, and rally people together. And not only will that create camaraderie, but people will be focused on what the actual outcome is, rather than screaming and throwing a fit and being like, this is wrong and this is a, just focus on fixing it. And I think like that attitude is like, okay, we understand, we have a mission, this is the vision forward, this is what we're doing. That's like, I would say, like project-based, campaign-based, initiative-based, conference-based. Like that happens. And then you have a retro and you understand, and it's like, this is why this broke. Like, how do we fix it next time? What could we have done better? Right? Like that's the time for that, rather than the time for like, let's just focus on fixing it and not placing blame on each other and no politics. So then there's, go ahead. Good.
I said final question, but I have a sub question. So I think it's how do you personally manage to find this calmness and peace so you can lead others? Like, do you have any mindset or, you know, something burns and it's human to be emotional, right? It's human to freak out sometimes. So what do you do to focus on this more creative, productive mode?
I mean, I think like the weeks, like what I said is creating that space for myself in the mornings is really important. That's part one. Like just being able to have me time that isn't like focused on specific tasks. Like that's where like my mind starts thinking again, because your brain can't open up and flow naturally when you're so pressured by other things that are like key things that you just need to be working on. Like my brain doesn't work that way. So what I need to do is constantly create space for myself. Like if I take a walk or working out or sometimes sleeping, like maybe like I'm at peace enough now where I can like think in the night and like I'll write up, like wake up and write a few things down. But, you know, it's definitely on the weekends, like taking time to just like walk and like spend time outside and not think about work in the traditional sense. Like that's when I'll come up with ideas. And it's like when I said this before, it's like thinking, not thinking. It's like when your brain is allowed to not think and it actually thinks as a byproduct of not focusing on certain things. Like I'll come up with great ideas because I'm not actively thinking. And that may not work for everyone. Like my husband comes up with, I don't know how he does it, but when he's in the shower, he'll take an hour shower and come out and have solved like the most complex of like challenges in his company. And I'm like, I don't understand. And he's like, I fixed it in the shower. And like, that's when he does his thinking. And I'm like, oh, that is like fascinating. Like I've never had a great shower idea. I really just haven't. But that works for him. And that's why he'll take an hour shower, because that's the time that he is alone and able to cycle through his head without, I guess, what he feels the pressure of the world on him. So I think it depends on people, but I think creating your unique space to be able to like have that time for yourself, especially if you're a creative person or you need to like work through complex problems in your head is creating that.
And it's such a great way to wrap up this episode. Productivity is so personal. Productivity is so personal. We are trying to look for the guru or for the book that will give us this perfect way to be productive. And the thing is, you got to try things out and you got to really try and figure out whether you need the 1 hour in the shower to come up with these prayers over from the
break. And I'll leave out one thing. Like I believe like a platform and a product for work like ClickUp is really, really, really helpful, because it organizes everything that you need to get done in the way that you want to work for your team. And it creates a workflow that really like helps you alleviate all this chaos and noise from your life, So it's amazing, right? Like a platform for work like that has been game changing, and I've used them all. So I'm very grateful that I get to work within a product and market it like that. But then the second side of that is like, to your point, like what is your own personal productivity and how do you get there? Because a platform won't solve for how you are the best version of yourself productively outside of that. So it's the marriage of finding the right technology, but then also the right rhythm and the right routine that allows you to get there. And I think if you have both of those things and you try a lot of different things, you'll be a really productive version of yourself, maybe the most.
There you go. And maybe what people are asking themselves is, where could we follow and find Melissa and get more content from her, get more inspiration from her? And the second part is we mentioned ClickUp a number of times, but I want you, if you can summarize, who is ClickUp for? You know, from the listeners here, who are the people that should get ClickUp, and what could it help them to achieve?
Cool. So you can find me on LinkedIn. I am on LinkedIn all the time. I respond to messages. I'm happy to chat. I love connecting with people. It's a really, I think, like wonderful part of my job, which is just connection. And two, ClickUp is for everyone. ClickUp is for teams of tens to thousands of people. We enable you to become the most productive version of yourself and of your team by aligning and having all of your work within one place. So your documents, your tasks, your whiteboards, your sprints, your tech, like everything that you need to get done, all in one platform so that you can focus on like what actually matters. So sign up for ClickUp today, www.clickup.com. It's an amazing tool that is, you know, it really flexes to the way that you want to be able to work. So every single department, marketers to HR to finance can use ClickUp, and it's a phenomenal product. And I promise that if you try it out, you'll be pretty excited about it.
Thank you so much, Melissa. Thank you for being with us for the second time, for
Thank
sharing all
you.
these insights. And thanks, everyone, for listening. And make sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube so you can get notifications for the new episodes. We keep on bringing you weekly guests to help you expand your horizon and boost your productivity personally and as a team. And if you really want to boost your team productivity, also personally, go to clickup.com and make sure to download the app. That was from me, Stoyan, and see you once again the next episode of Productivity Mastery.
Thank you.
Thank you guys for listening. Make sure to subscribe to my monthly newsletter by visiting stoyanyankov.com. And also learn about the Perform methodology and the Perform book, as well as our various personal and team coaching offers. Stay tuned and keep performing.